Millions of people suffer from the effects of undiagnosed sleep problems. The National Sleep Foundation estimates that 47 million American adults may be putting themselves at risk for injury and health and behavior problems because they're not getting enough sleep. In his new book, The Mystery of Sleep, Dr. Meyer Krieger, a world authority on the science of sleep and a pioneer in the study of sleep disorders in women, shares the latest developments in research as well as pragmatic advice for everyone who struggles with sleep. The new book is The Mystery of Sleep, Why a Good Night's Rest is Vital to a Better, Healthier Life. It is published by Yale University Press, and we welcome Dr. Meyer Krieger to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, it's always a great pleasure for me to talk about sleep.
Why is sleep, as the title indicates, such a mystery?
Well, it's a mystery. Just to put it into perspective, when I first got into sleep as a field, which would have been about 40 years ago, there was literally nothing known about sleep. Basically, the assumption was you went to sleep, you woke up, and nothing bad can ever happen. And it turns out we've learned a great deal about sleep, and there's a great deal that we still don't know. We don't really know what the function of sleep actually is, although we do know many things that actually happen during sleep. For example, we start to consolidate our memories when we're sleeping. During sleep, there are certain hormones that go up and down and control many, many functions. And if we don't sleep enough, our mood becomes cranky, we're irritable. So there are many important things that happen during sleep. We don't know whether sleep has the same function in all species, for example. Does a lion who's sleeping, who's just eaten its prey, is sleep for that animal the same of the same importance as it is for humans who have to have a certain mood, who have to be able to remember things? So it's still and always has been really fascinating.
When you look at all of the problems that people have when it comes to sleep issues, undiagnosed sleep problems, and even diagnosed sleep problems, as you said, many years ago, we didn't even know that much about sleep. So how much of these problems are new, and how much of them have been around for a long time and are just becoming diagnosed?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are some problems that are probably very old, although they weren't recognized until the 60s and 70s. For example, sleep apnea, which is mostly associated with obesity, for example. It was described really in like 300 BC, around the time of Alexander the Great. There are some historical descriptions of a person that probably had sleep apnea. More recently, some of the problems that we're seeing are problems that are related to lifestyle. We can blame Thomas Edison, for example, the light bulb and the fact that we now have a 24-hour world. People are losing sleep. Probably right now, people are sleeping about 1 to 2 hours less than they did a couple of hundred years ago. And so we have chronic sleep deprivation. And we also now recognize that there are many abnormalities that occur because of changes in our body clock. We have an exquisite clock in our brain that keeps track of things and keeps track of time. And we know, for example, that in some people, the clock changes. It changes, for example, in adolescents and college students very often, and they go to sleep later and later. And if they go to sleep later and later, but they start their day early in the morning, they become very, very sleep deprived, and we now know that sleep deprivation can be really dangerous.
Let me throw out a scenario and have you respond to it. But if someone has something going on, whether it be something that emotional happened that day or whatever the case may be, and they just don't have a good night's sleep. They went to bed at 10, they wake up at 7, but they just didn't sleep. Have a good night's sleep, but they were up, they were down, they were looking at the clock every hour. How much of an effect does that have on them, an immediate effect and even a long-term effect over the course of a week?
Well, it'll have both the effects that you mentioned. There will be an immediate effect. The person who doesn't sleep well, doesn't sleep enough for a given night, is going to be sleepy. They're going to try to wake themselves up using various methods, and the usual method is to drink a lot of coffee, which in fact can make the subsequent night's sleep equally bad. And one of the things that we know is that sleep debt, in other words, if you lose an hour of sleep one night and you lose another hour of sleep the subsequent night, that sort of builds up and you become sleepier and sleepier. And the problem with becoming sleepier and sleepier and having a sleep debt is that many people do not perceive how impaired they actually are. And if someone has, for example, a sleeping, let's say 6 hours a night for about a week, they might be as impaired as if they had been awake the entire night. So it really does build up.
When you think about the sleep problems that we mentioned, what numbers are greater in the sense of the people who get a good night's sleep? Because basically when you read the book, you get the idea that most of us don't do it right.
Well, yeah, and we don't do it right not because necessarily we don't know what to do. The problem is that most people do not make their sleep a priority. In other words, it's like they kind of wish they didn't have to sleep because there's all these other interesting things that they could be doing, and they don't appreciate the fact that sleeping is like a terrific thing for them to be doing because it'll improve their mood, it'll improve their health, and it'll improve so many things about them that it's not even funny. So that's the real problem. The real problem in many cases is not making it a priority and saying, you know what, I'm only going to sleep 4 to 5 hours and I'll try to sort of make do with that. And that really doesn't work.
I certainly don't mean to make this a political discussion in any way, shape, or form, but when you hear somebody like the President of the United States say, oh, I don't sleep that much, I can sleep for 4 hours, are there people who can do that, or is that just something that people say that isn't really true?
Well, I mean, there are probably some people who on some days can get away with sleeping, 4 hours as our current president has bragged about, and there's a certain amount of sort of macho in that kind of, declaration. The reality is that most people cannot function well on 4 hours, and if our current president ever decided to be an airline pilot, I do not want him to be flying my airplane. In other words, it's we know that 4 hours for most people is not even close to being the right amount of sleep. You know, talking about a previous president, President Obama, about a year ago, he mentioned that at some kind of a breakfast meeting, as I recall, that once he stopped being president, he would like to sleep for like 2 or 3 or 4 months. So President Obama was sleep deprived as well. And President Clinton, when in his last day of office, there was an interesting article in Time magazine, which actually in which he was quoted as saying that every important mistake he ever made was when he was sleep deprived. So sleep deprivation is something that it affects everybody, including the presidents of the United States.
This is a follow-up to a question I asked you a few moments ago, I guess, but is it possible to catch up with the sleep in the sense of if you miss a night and you're only sleeping 4 or 5 hours, but then the next night you have the luxury of sleeping 9, 10, 12 hours, does that make up for it?
Yes, it can make up for it. And what can make up for it in the short term, although it won't solve the problem, is a nap. And one of the things that I tell many patients is that if you're really tired during the day, a 30 to 40 minute nap can be life-saving, actually. If you're sleepy and driving and your eyelids get heavy, stop driving, get off the road, and take a short nap. A nap can be very refreshing, and it can literally save the person's life.
Do How much do we know about what it is about us that when we are drowsy, when we are driving, when we are sitting at our desks and we're falling asleep, that there seems to be the denial that we have if somebody shakes us and says, oh, by the way, you're falling asleep, why don't you go lay down, that you say, no, no, I'm fine. What is it about us and even that belief that you're not sleepy?
That's a terrific question, and it's something that has been fascinating people for a long time, which is that if sleepiness and also being drunk will often result in a misperception of impairment. So a person, for example, who is drunk that starts to drive, they do not believe that they're actually impaired very often. In other words, it's the brain misinterprets the mood. And the other thing that we know is that when people are sleep deprived and sleepy, their judgment becomes poor. And so there's a perception issue, there's a judgment issue, and this is something that we've been able to change in terms of drunk driving. It's now considered a big deal, and just as we need to take care of drunk driving as a problem, we need to take care of the operation of dangerous stuff if you're very sleep deprived. So we don't want people who are sleep deprived to be flying our aircraft. We don't want the engineers on locomotives to actually be sleepy while they are working. And I could give you examples of accidents that have killed many people from sleep deprived people in the transportation business.
I want to talk to you for a few moments about dreams or nightmares. And it seems that when you read serious books on sleep, that often that idea of dreaming is sort of set aside for dream analysis and so forth. But you write about it in a fascinating manner. Talk to us about the dreams that we have and the commonality, really, of those dreams.
Well, all of us dream of 3 to 5 times a night unless we have a sleep disorder that can get rid of dreaming. And most people will remember either one or none of their dreams. Dreams are sort of they're sort of an entrance into another world that we don't understand. For example, we know that the features of dreaming, and for example, dreaming occurs in a state called rapid eye movement sleep. So we know, for example, that newborn babies have rapid eye movement sleep, and it's sort of, when you start to think about it, is are they dreaming, and what could they possibly be dreaming about? We know that virtually all mammals actually dream. Anybody who has a dog can recognize when their dog is dreaming. What are they dreaming about? And is the function of dreaming in a dog the same as it is in a human being, for example? But we also know that when we dream, dreaming is a very, very primitive state. And what I mean by that is that when we dream, we become an awful lot like lizards. We no longer control our temperature. We no longer accurately control our heart rate or our blood pressure. These things sort of float around, and it's a very, very different state. And we continue to learn about dreams, and one of the things that we've learned about dreams or REM sleep is important to consolidate memories. It plays an important role in memory. We also recognize that there are diseases where dreaming becomes a problem. And there are some people who normally when we dream, for example, we are paralyzed, so we can't react to our own dreams. There are some people where this doesn't work, and they actually physically react to what they are dreaming, and they can really harm their bed partner in this state. They might punch them and throw them out of bed. So it can be a very, very serious situation. And the other condition where we see abnormalities related to dreaming is in people that have post-traumatic stress disorder. They have repetitive nightmares, and these nightmares can occur nightly for decades. I've had patients who've had nightmares for 30, 40 years every single night that replay the trauma that they witnessed or participated in.
I mentioned in the last question this idea of dream analysis, that people often want to know what their dreams mean. And I'm curious, as for you and in your work in sleep, does that play a role? So that if I'm dreaming about eating blueberry pudding and then I go to a manual and it says, oh, that means that your father didn't love you. I mean, do you think of that as something serious? Or,
well, yeah. Okay. So dream analysis is frequently used, for example, in psychoanalysis done by psychiatrists who are versed in it. Now, the interpretation of dreams is not anything new. A lot of people believe that this started, you know, with Sigmund Freud in the early 1900s. In fact, there is an Egyptian book of dreams that's like thousands of years old. You know, they had sages saying, if you dream this, it means that. And we don't, at this point, pay a lot of attention to what people are actually dreaming. What we pay attention to is whether or not their dreams are pathological, whether their dreams represent this condition that I mentioned, where they start to physically react to their dream content, or they have post-traumatic stress, and that's something that we actually need to treat. The process of psychoanalysis that psychoanalysts use, it takes a long time to deal with the psychological issues that result in the psychoanalyst being able to say, aha, we think that this is what this dream represents in your particular case. You know, interestingly enough, when people started to write about the interpretation of dreams, we didn't even know where dreams were located. We didn't even know in the 1800s or the very early 1900s that the brain was where all of this stuff was actually happening. And Sigmund Freud wrote about dreams about 20 years before we even knew that the brain had electrical activity when people slept. So there's still a lot of fascination with dreams, because they are a fascinating state, but we don't understand everything about them.
I am interested in this idea that so many of our abnormalities and problems in sleeping that go undiagnosed, where do you believe the first place should be for someone who is concerned about their sleep and their sleep habits?
If their problem is they can't sleep enough or they sleep too much, both of those can actually be major problems. They need to first discuss it with their own family members and then go to a family doctor. What they shouldn't do is sort of say, well, it's not that important, it's just sleep, what can possibly go wrong with my sleep? They should do something about it. And the reason they should do something about it is that, number one, if they have a sleep disorder such as sleep apnea, where people stop breathing during sleep, that can have tremendously negative consequences, such as stroke, heart disease, heart attack, and so forth. So they need to deal with it, and they shouldn't really ignore it. So that's number one. And number two is that they need to make sleep and feeling wide awake and alert a priority for themselves. And if they're not wide awake and alert, they need to bring this to the attention of their doctor. And if their doctor doesn't deal with it, then they really should go to a specialist, especially if their sleep is very, very abnormal.
The name of the book is The Mystery of Sleep, Why a Good Night's Rest is Vital to a Better, Healthier Life. Dr. Meyer Krieger is a professor in the Yale School of Medicine, chief editor of the most widely used sleep medicine textbook, Principles and Practice of Sleep Medicine. Again, the new book is The Mystery of Sleep. Dr. Krieger, thank you very much for joining us this morning. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Mystery of Sleep, it is published by Yale University Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.